So hello everybody, good morning and welcome back to Overheating. Last week I spoke about the information age, changes in information technology and to some extent developments in the technology of transportation, and I connected this enormous, massive growth and change in the realm of information technology to other overheating processes, showing how the world is being connected in real time increasingly intensely and densely today. Today I'm going to look at we're going to talk about a more, you might say, physical, material aspect of overheating, although you could say that, you know, the information technology clearly has a material side as well, because it relies on infrastructure and on rare minerals dug up in eastern Congo and elsewhere through mining. But still, mining, extractive industries, you know, it's inherently material, it's physical. We talk about heavy stuff. They fill up big cargo ships with the stuff, and you know, it goes into factories, and you need very large machinery these days in order to make good use of, say, iron or coal. So extractive industries. Why is it that mining should be so important to an anthropology of overheating? Well, there are two main reasons. One reason is that simply the fact that it's everywhere now. Well, not everywhere. Nothing is everywhere, but it's in a lot of places. There is an increased interest and an increased engagement in mining, and there's a scramble for mineral, which is a result of the world being overheated. There's a scarcity of the raw materials for industry and for energy and so on and so forth. When we started out on this research project called Overheating back in 2012-13, we knew that mining would be a part of it, but we didn't envision that it would be such a central and important part. So among other things, as you would have noticed, we've got a book out. You know, we Robert Pipers and I edited a book on the anthropology of mining, which we hadn't planned to do, but it somehow seemed necessary, because wherever we went, mining somehow entered into the picture. Obviously, I mean, you knew that Robert Pipers, who was a PhD student on the project, that he was going to look at mining. But we didn't know that Astrid Stensrud, whom you're going to meet later this semester, she's going to give the lecture on climate. We didn't expect her to engage with mining, because she was interested in water in Peru and the privatization of water, water as a commodity, and not as a common good, not as a commons, but a commodity to be purchased and to be owned, and so on. Turned out that at the end of the day, mining came into her project as well, and we hadn't expected that. So that's one reason why mining is important in anthropology of overheating. It's massive. Many of you would know about the, you would be aware of this strange, ambiguous region in northwest Africa known as West Sahara, which is a strip of land, really a strip of desert, located, you know, southeast of the Canary Islands, between Morocco and Mauritania, where there is an independence movement called Polisario, which fights the Moroccan state, which occupies the territory in violation of international law. Why is it that Morocco should spend so many resources and risk its international reputation occupying a strip of desert? Well, I mean, there's a short answer to this. Chemical fertilizer, which is essential for industrial food production, for intensive, you know, highly productive agriculture, consists basically of two components, well, maybe others as well, but one component is nitrogen, which can easily be produced in a laboratory. The other is phosphate, which cannot be produced artificially, and there is only so much phosphate in the world, and surprise, surprise, one of the largest deposits of phosphate, which has to be exploited through and dug out through mining is located in West Sahara. So it's economically incredibly important and can also be strategically important for Morocco in the future, when perhaps there will be food scarcity and where the need for efficient fertilizer will be even greater than today. So that's the story about Morocco. So that's, I mean, that's one obvious reason why mining is important, simply because it's pervasive and it is overheating and it's growing. You know, in Australia, where I worked, and I'm going to talk a little bit about my Australian work later today, you know, mining is part and parcel of the Australian way of life, right? I mean, it's iconic to the Australian self-understanding that, you know, mining, I mean, they had gold rushes, real and fictional gold rushes aimed to lure free Europeans, Englishmen mainly, to come to Australia, because Australia was mainly a penal colony, a prison colony, right, in the mid-19th century. So mining goes back into Australian mythology, and it's still incredibly important for the Australian economy. It is to Australia what oil and gas is to Norway. Now, what used to be a very large mine in Australia is now a middle-sized mine. What used to be a mega mine in Australia 20 years ago is now a large mine, and the new mega mines are even bigger than before. So it's growing. The other main reason that mining is important to an anthropology of overheating is the fact that if you think back at Travick and Hornburg and their article about the contradictions, resource contradictions mainly, of growth capitalism based on fossil fuels, which you'll also find more than traces of in my book Overheating, you'll see that their view is that there is something inherently destructive. It is true that owing to the second law of thermodynamics, energy doesn't disappear, it just takes a new form, and in the end it dissipates into heat. So the energy which is being used when you burn coal to generate energy, to generate electricity or other kinds of other forms of energy, the energy remains somehow, but it can no longer be used by humans. So it's being used up. So in other words, the destructive character of fossil fuel, the fossil fuel economy, comes across very clearly when it comes to minerals, because you use stuff up which is never coming back. You know, it took the planet more than 300 million years to produce the coal deposits that we are still enjoying the fruits of, right? And the side effects. And we're now burning it up within just a few generations. So mining is important. Let me, before we move on, say just a couple of words about the distinction between extraction and production. And by production, in this context, I refer mainly to agricultural production. Agricultural production can be sustainable in the sense that it can sustain itself indefinitely. You can, you know, it's cyclical, follows the seasons. You have livestock, you slaughter them. I mean, you take the milk, you take the skins, someone eats the meat. But before this happens, before someone takes the meat, they have offspring, okay? They get lambs or calves or so on, and you know, they have their children that grow up, and which will repeat the cycle. So the cycle is being repeated. This is also the logic of agriculture. There are places in the world, like in Haile, New Guinea, where people, the locals, have produced food for their own consumption for thousands of years without really affecting the fundamentals of the ecosystem. So unless there had been other changes going on there, such as mining, that I'm coming to in a little while, they could have gone on indefinitely producing food in this way. So that's the point about, that's the idea about production. Whereas with extraction, you take something out and nothing's coming back. Footnote. Is fishing an extractive kind of industry or extractive kind of activity? Yes, it can be if there is overfishing. You deplete the fish stocks, which is taking place. I mean, I could have given a whole lecture about this in the context of overheating, couldn't I? the way in which overfishing is now threatening so many species of fish. Actually, I will be mentioning it in the later lecture. But if you fish sustainably, you can see if you can look at it as a form of stewardship or production, even. Not as if it's you who produce a fish. Well, people do produce fish now, farmed fish, okay? Farmed salmon in Western Norway and elsewhere. But ecological production, the ecosystem is capable of reproducing the fish stocks if you don't overfish. End of footnote. So think about the contrast between extracting and producing as one way of coming to grips with mining and what mining is about. Now, as so often, I start with some statistics. Coal and civilization. We have a civilization which is built on coal. Some of you may think, and people may think, that coal isn't really the energy of the 19th century. It's so Victorian, with the sort of smoking chimneys and the coal dust that settles on window sills and furniture and streets and in your hair and in your nose and everywhere. I'm old enough to remember the time when this was the feeling you got when you walked around in London. You know, the industrial capital of the Victorian age, okay? I didn't live in the Victorian age, but in the 1970s, you could smell the coal. You saw the smoke coming out of the chimneys, many of them from private houses. These chimneys are still there. Look, notice it when you next time you visit London. Lots of little chimneys on these red brick blocks of flats or houses with a sort of two up, two down variety. But they're no longer in use. Right, because it's the city has been cleaned up. So many have got the impression that coal is something of the past. It's not. It's still growing. Yes, other forms of energy are also growing. Its younger siblings, oil and gas, are sometimes more convenient than coal. Sustainable energy, nuclear, in countries like France, which is one of the few countries in the world which has a thriving sort of nuclear power supply. Or hydroelectric, less controversial, in a country like Norway, or even solar. Yeah, it's growing. All of this is growing and it's doing well. But coal is also growing. Everything about energy seems to be growing. And now I'd like you to look at this chart. This is not coal production, but it's about coal exports. And as you can see, Australia, a very, very large coal exporter, large coal producer, they use a lot of coal themselves as well. More than 80% of their electricity comes from coal. I mean, Australia, unlike Norway, is not a mountainous country. It's fairly dry and flat, so there's not much by way of hydroelectricity. But look at Indonesia on this chart. Indonesia was a non-entity in the world of fossil fuels until 30 years ago, and it's now... This statistics ends in 2009, and it's now the largest coal exporter in the world. And things are happening fast. I sometimes felt that, you know, when I started to get interested in this stuff, in overheating and coal and energy and that kind of thing, about, you know, 12 years ago or so, maybe 10 years ago, Australia was by far the largest coal exporter in the world. And I then somehow just went out and had a cup of coffee, and when I came back, it was Indonesia. Or rather, Indonesia was about to catch up. So it's massive. And think about the implications of coal mining, large-scale open-pit coal mining, not just for the ecology of islands like Borneo, rainforests, orangutans, lots of endemic species, but also for the people who live there, who either are evicted through, you know, they're being dispossessed, harking back to one of the earlier lectures, accumulation by dispossession, they're being dispossessed, or they become coal miners themselves. Now look at this chart, which predicts that, as you can see, that coal is going down. That would be in accordance with, well, at least it would begin to start to try to approach some of the international climate agreements that governments around the world have reached. But we're still, you know, in 2020, so we're still sort of, it's still growing, okay? and it's predicted to decrease, but who knows. It's still growing, and these are the largest producers. China is the largest producer, but they use all of it themselves. They even import coal from places like Australia. And Indonesia is growing still, you see. But they are also expected to decline by around 2030, according to this projection by statisticians. Now let's take a look at the global trajectory of coal. You heard about the container ship. I've spoken about connectedness. Last week I spoke about the internet, which is, you know, what travels with the internet and with a mobile phone is stuff that weighs less than 1 gram, as I say. You know, it's weightless, whereas coal is not weightless. It's shipped through very large barges, you know, large ships. You know, Gladstone, Australia, where I worked, has one of the largest. It's one of the largest coal ports in the world. And in Australia, second only to Newcastle. Not Newcastle, England, huh? Newcastle, Australia, which sits at the end of the Hunter Valley, which I'm going to talk about after the break, which is also the site of massive coal mining these days. But let's just have a quick look at this. 2018 is almost last week. The way in which coal travels around the world. You can see that the largest producer in the world, which is China, doesn't export any coal. India doesn't export coal. India has very large coal mines. It imports a bit of coal. And so does China. Many of these arrows, they point towards Japan and the Far East, right? And some point towards Europe. Not much that points towards South America and Africa, which shows that the use of energy and in fact the carbon footprint of these continents is much less than in the global north, in which I will now include China. Indonesia, massive exporter, as you could see in 2018. So here we are again. This is coal production. And look at Indonesia. Now this graph ends, right, in 2015, so a few years ago. China, USA, Indonesia. Indonesia is now a larger coal producer than Australia, which it wasn't until I went out and had that coffee. But look at the growth from nothing in the early 1990s to a massive amount. And think of what this does to the society. It produces wealth. Don't forget this. Coal produces wealth. In the past of my father, who was a working class kid from northern Norway, who grew up in the 1930s and 40s. When he grew up and there was a foul smell in Tromsø from a factory, they would say, you know what they said. They said, it smells money. Right. It doesn't matter if it smells bad because it smells money. Same with coal mining. But there are dilemmas, and I'm coming to those towards the end of this lecture. Another major source of economic development, industrialization, growth, transportation, overheating is iron. So let's have a look at who produces the most iron ore in the world and exports it, okay? World iron ore export sources. Well, again, you see Australia. Australia doing rather well, as is Brazil. Other countries produce iron, but they use much of it themselves. Australia is a very large country, most of it desert, thinly populated, and rich in virtually any mineral you can think of. From, you know, gold to uranium. So it's a mining place. Now, so for that reason, partly, I'm going to take the liberty of showing you little bits and pieces of my own field site a few years ago in central Queensland, Australia. Sort of halfway, if you're familiar with the map of Australia, you know, the eastern strip, the eastern seaboard is where most of the people live. Melbourne, Sydney, Brisbane are you know, the larger cities in Australia. Then you have Perth on the west coast, which is a very isolated and for that reason very fascinating place. But that's where people live. So Gladstone is located about halfway, you might say, between Brisbane and Townsville. And moving further up, you come to Cairns and to those places where surfers like to go. Gladstone is an emphatically industrial place. It's marinated in coal and gas. It's saturated by it. It's where the wealth comes from. And everybody knows, you know, some of the environmentally minded people in Gladstone say that, you know, we're not against industry. How could we be against industry? Were we to be against industry, we would be against this place. But we want them to do it right. We want them to do it right. In other words, minimize pollution. Make sure that you try to not destroy more than absolutely necessary. But it's somehow a necessary evil. Now I'm going to just walk you through the value chain of the aluminium production. I mean, aluminium, alumina and aluminium, these are two different things, are produced on a very large scale in Gladstone. And that's where their industrial adventure started, in fact, in the 1960s, with the opening of one of the largest alumina factories that the world has ever seen. But let's start with where they get the energy from, because you need energy. Alumina production and aluminium production, very high, very energy-intensive forms of industry. And of course based on extraction. So that's the reason why there are aluminium factories in or smelters in Norway on the west coast, because there is an abundant supply of cheap energy through hydroelectricity. So the Callide mine in the interior of Queensland, not very far from Gladstone, that's where they dig out the coal. Not very pretty, is it? There are a few trees left, but not many. But that's how it is. In order to make an omelette, you have to break some eggs. So the Callide mine produces energy for the power station and for the aluminium, the alumina refinery and the aluminium smelter, which are two different factories. I'm coming to that as well. So here's a photo from Gladstone itself. Lots of empty coal wagons that have been emptied, and they were, you know, they came in from the Callide mine to supply coal for mainly local industry. In fact, coal for export is produced in larger mines further afield. So this is QAL. The QAL, as I mean, everybody in Gladstone knows what QAL is. Queensland Alumina Limited, the world's largest alumina refinery when it was finished in and opened in 1967, and marked the start of the industrial, as I say, miracle, as many Gladstonites would call it, the industrial, the growth of wealth and prosperity and the growth of the city itself and the overheating, you might say, of Gladstone. So that's where the alumina is built. But the alumina needs raw materials, bauxite, which is a mineral mainly mined in the tropics and subtropics. Norway gets most of its bauxite from Jamaica. But here you get it from Australia. So just further up in the same state in Australia, further north in Weipa, Rio Tinto Alcan, the huge sort of mining corporation, which also has operations in other countries, one of the largest mining companies in the world, and which is Australian. It's not entirely Australian owned, not anymore, but it is Australian. And they owned partly every part of the value chain. They owned the mine, the Callide mine. They owned the bauxite mine. They even had ownership of the railway and of the power station. Much of this has now been sold to other interests. But at the time, 60s and 70s, Rio Tinto virtually owned the city of Gladstone. And they got the bauxite from their mine in northern Queensland, from Weipa. Now these are the tailings. This is the waste from alumina. You see, it's very red stuff. Okay, you produce the alumina, which can not yet be used for making stuff. You know, like the casings of this computer, which is made of aluminium. but it's the beginning. And the aluminium production produces these tailings, which is waste, which is spoken of as by city councillors and members of the sort of industrial elite in Gladstone as completely harmless, not poisonous, not toxic at all. Not everybody agrees. It's ugly and it has effects on the ecosystem, and certainly if there is a flood and leakage, which there have been. But they're stored, you know, in big reservoirs that you could see. I mean, that photo, I took it from the air once when I was traveling to Gladstone from Brisbane. In order for the alumina to be turned into aluminium, that can be used for all kinds of stuff. Aluminium is a great metal, you know, it's very useful, very convenient. And it's quite new, much, much newer than iron and gold and all of these other, because it has to be processed in a fairly complex way, as you can see. You don't just dig out aluminium, you have to produce it from bauxite. Bauxite, alumina, and then the smelter on Boyne Island, which is just south of Gladstone, produces the aluminium. And this is what aluminium looks like in its pristine state. Aluminium pellets, little things that can be melted and shaped and turned into, well, computer casings and maybe even this, I don't know if this cup is made of aluminium, I'm not sure. lots of stuff that surrounds us is aluminium. So this is the value chain of aluminium in Gladstone. Now, let me indulge and show you a few more photos from my fieldwork. This elevated excavator, is sitting next to the highway, just outside of the city. I mean, on the way to another town, you see it. It's a landmark, just like a statue. I mean, if you produced pineapples, you may have a giant pineapple to show for you. If you're proud of your national history, you may have a monument of one of the great warriors or kings or. And if you're cultured, you may have a monument of one of your poets. Not in Gladstone, they have these kinds of monuments, and they're proud of it. You know, it's us, in a way. So that illustrates what kind of place it is, doesn't it? And here is a newer development. As you can see, these pipelines transport liquid natural gas. They transport gas, which is then being condensed and cooled down. I mean, the opposite in way of overheating, but it is a form of overheating in at the liquid LNG terminal on Curtis Island, which is just off Gladstone. But as you can see, at the time, the photo was taken in 2014, they were still laying out the pipelines, and they meander, you know, like enormous snakes through the landscape. And the landscape, as you can see, has already been altered beyond recognition. They've just ripped away the vegetation, very similar to what they do in open pit mining, to make room for these huge pipelines that roll through the landscape. So, as I say, I mean, in order to make an omelette, you've got to break some eggs. And in order to benefit from fossil fuels, you not only affect the climate, but you also affect the landscape. And I'm also coming to some of the implications of these landscape alterations after the break. So, no more about LNG, but that's another big source of energy, a very promising source of energy. But LNG, natural gas, is not, cannot be exploited and mined, as it were, in the same way as coal in Australia, because the gas lies in pockets beneath the ground, inside the rock, and it has to be somehow, it has to be coaxed out by fracking, you know, by making little explosions in the ground that tease out the gas, or maybe through chemicals. And you need lots of little boreholes, lots of little wells, in order to produce enough gas for it to be worthwhile. So in the Queensland landscape, you can see, I mean, on farms, in forest, even in the scrubland, you can see the landscape dotted with these little wells of natural gas. Quite unlike the large mines, like this one, which is really not a very big mine. This is a small mine, but I had a special interest in it. It's a limestone mine, and limestone is for making cement. Right? It's used for making cement, and they have to pump out water, as you see, in order to get to the limestone. They have to dig deeper and deeper.